Okay, it's 3 in the afternoon in Sao Paulo and the streetlights are on. On an ordinary August day here in Brazil's largest city, winter sunshine would still be flooding the streets for a few more hours as children walk home from school and the pavements buzz with activity. But it's 3 in the afternoon and the streetlights are all on because the sky is completely black. The sky is black because it's full of smoke, and it's full of smoke because the Amazon is burning. 40% of the world's rainforests are in the Amazon. It's called the world's lung for a reason. It holds up to 140 billion tonnes of carbon. That's up to 4 years of global emissions. Aside from being possibly the most important carbon sink in the world, it's home to around 20 million indigenous people and 1 in 10 known animal species on Earth. The huge fires currently burning through the Amazon can be seen from space. They come after June this year saw an 88% increase in logging in the forest, and the forest is now rapidly approaching what scientists call its tipping point, which means when 20 to 25% of the forest is destroyed, it will no longer have its ability to recycle water, that is, actually maintain itself, and will die in a couple of decades. The Amazon is not actually dying, as the saying goes. The Amazon is being killed, and the people killing it have names and addresses. One of these addresses is the Palacio de Alvarado, the luxury home of Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro has made the rape of the Amazon a central tenet of his presidency in order to secure land and resources for big business. On Thursday, he took to social media to declare that everything indicates that these fires have actually been started by environmental activists who are missing their money. So mass extinction events and large sections of the planet becoming completely inhospitable to life no longer are sort of far-flung apocalyptic dystopias. These questions of an existential nature are weighing down upon us today. Last year, the UN-sponsored Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued a 12-year deadline, marking 2030 as the year when the climate crisis will become truly irreversible. This is a relatively conservative estimate that is actually being rejected by many climate scientists, some of whom place the mark at closer to 18 months from now. So what's the response from powerful figures all over the world? For years, the consensus seemed to be that these people at the top of society who headed up these destructive industries were just climate deniers, people who continued drilling, mining and deforesting because they just couldn't see or didn't believe in the consequences of it. And it's safe to say, I think, that the past few years have blown this myth totally out of the water. The super rich of our society have revealed themselves to be callous, depraved, and greedy in the face of climate crisis rather than just stupid. Most of them are perfectly aware of the science behind climate change, and yet they continue to see the Earth as little more than a pile of resources waiting to be exploited. So nowhere is this more evident than in the sort of myriad of schemes that the rich have cooked up to build floating island mansions, atmosphere-regulated bubbles, or even actually colonies on Mars. These are all ways for them to continue their lavish lifestyles and exploit the Earth, even as untold devastation rains down around them. Meanwhile, mainstream politics has shown itself to have nothing to offer ordinary people, the millions of people who are active and angry around this question, except for sort of meaningless platitudes that come in the form of electric car subsidies or climate agreements that are always torn up as easily as they get devised. Take our political options here in Australia, for example. We have the Liberals and their insatiable hunger for fossil fuels. I think that manifested most recently in Scott Morrison's like emphatically racist contempt for struggling island nations threatened by climate change at the Pacific Islands Forum in Tuvalu. But the Labor Party are no clean alternative. While the Victorian Andrews Labor government is currently rallying to cut down sacred 1,000-year-old Indigenous trees, Queensland's Palaszczuk has fallen over herself to fast-track the Adani mine and open up the Galilee Basin, those are her words, to a half-dozen more filthy coal enterprises, including one of Clive Palmer's pet projects. And to cap it off, draconian protest laws have just been rolled out to further criminalise the environmental activists who are putting their bodies on the line to save the future. A socialist analysis of the environmental crisis means being frank about the situation at hand. We're staring down the barrel of the Earth's sixth major extinction event, and politicians are determined to do nothing about or actually encourage the continued expansion of fossil fuels and environmental destruction. But a socialist analysis, I think, also gives reason to hope. I don't think we've actually lost the planet yet to the greed of the rich and powerful. Our side is strong, our side is very angry, and I think we can get rid of this whole rotten system through the act of revolution. And I'm going to argue that we need to do that if we want to turn the tide on climate change. So the need for anti-capitalist politics becomes really clear when we try to come to terms with just how we got to this point. You know, especially in recent times when knowledge of the ill effects of climate change is so widespread, if it's so detrimental to human life, why do we seem to keep perpetuating it? And I think the answer to that is not everyone is culpable, actually. Despite sort of vague terms that are used in the media or maybe some of your classes about man-made climate change or the Anthropocene, the environmental impact that stems from civilian consumption, that is, you know, buying our groceries, driving cars, using our appliances, etc., is like absurdly minute compared to that of the biggest polluters in the world. In 2017, a study revealed that 71% of global emissions are caused by just 100 companies, and the US military alone contributes more to global pollution than 140 countries combined. We should keep in mind that there are 195 countries in the whole world. So everywhere, it's massive companies and not ordinary people who are deciding to dig up coal, drill oil, destroy forests and frack for gas. But these polluting companies and institutions are still headed up by people, allegedly. And these people, rich as they are, live on the same planet as the rest of us. They will ostensibly feel those effects of climate change too. So why should they want to oversee pollution and environmental havoc? So here is the crux of the capitalist system and why, if we're ever going to see a solution to the climate crisis, we have to completely overturn it. Marx recognised that under capitalism, production, meaning everything we create as a society, is organised according to profit and not human need. This means that things are made to sell on a market rather than to actually fulfil anyone's needs or wants. So anyone living in Sydney would know about the massive amount of people who are forced to sleep on our streets every night. And you probably also know about the even bigger number of homes in this city that are empty, unsold, bought as, you know, third, fifth or eighth investment properties. These homes can lay vacant while people stay homeless because they were not made to house people. They were made to be sold for a profit on the real estate market. For as long as humans have been a sort of distinct species, we have acted on the environment and had it act on us in turn. It's a symbiotic sort of relationship for food, warmth, shelter, etc., based on what was needed to fill our needs and wants while ensuring the survival of resources. Capitalism is only urged on by its central profit motive. This perverts this relationship, I think, into one of exploitation. There is no upper limit placed on what you can take, dig up, or burn from the earth when the only goal is making as much money as possible. The most obvious impact of the profit motive on the environment is probably in the energy sector. The production of energy sources is not arranged around effectiveness or sustainability. For example, renewable technology has been like quite well developed for years now. I was reading an article the other day about how scientists estimate that the entire world could be powered from the solar power generated from a relatively small, unpopulated area of the Arizona desert. But renewables don't turn a consistent profit. You know, you'll know this if you ever pick up a copy of The Economist, which month after month runs these hand-wringing articles about how mass installation of wind power or solar power would actually cost energy corporations billions and eventually send them under, therefore it's just not possible. The impact of the capitalist profit motive, though, runs much deeper in its impact on the environment than simply the commitment of the rich to non-renewables. Due to the sheer number of capitalist forces who are battling it out on the market, turning a profit is all about outdoing and undercutting your rivals. This means obsessively gouging the planet for as many resources as possible while also cutting costs. I think a really good example of this is Australia's agricultural sector. So much of the massive Murray-Darling Basin, which is the key water source for New South Wales and Victoria, is now hovering at around 1% to 2% of a healthy capacity, and the little water that remains is actually very poor quality. Most people experiencing the immediate effects of the drought are very poor people in small and regional towns. Most of them are actually Indigenous. And analysts have sort of ummed and ahed for a long time about the state of the basin and how it got to this point. But I think interviews with locals in these towns has been extremely telling. The consensus is that it's the big cotton farmers, millionaires in the area, who are able to run completely rampant with the water supply and have done this perhaps irreversible damage. Cotton is one of the thirstiest crops in the world, and in a logical system, it would make no sense to grow it en masse in a place like Australia with a very dry and hot climate. But cotton is also one of the most profitable cash crops in the world. It's convenient to grow for direct sale on the market. So the profits of a few rich cotton farmers are prioritised over the preservation of one of Australia's largest and most important water sources. So if capitalism is arranged in such a terrible way, according to the most twisted logic, why has it been allowed to continue like this? Capitalism is a society divided by class. So one of these classes is what Marx called the bourgeoisie, what we might call the ruling class or the 1%. These are the people at the top of society with an obscenely disproportionate share of global wealth. The number is shrinking all the time, but a recent Oxfam study reported that 26 people globally hold as much wealth as the poorest 50% of the planet. So due to this immense amount of wealth and power, capitalists are able to run their various companies and endeavours basically as dictatorships. They get to say how, when and why business goes ahead, and you don't have to reach too far to imagine the realities of this. If you've ever worked, you know that even things like the tone of your voice or the look on your face are not under your control. And this goes doubly for any impacts that your industry or workplace might have on the environment. You know, as if workers get any say over whether or not their factory is spewing emissions into the atmosphere, over whether or not the store they work at actually recycles their waste or just dumps it offshore. These things are not up to us, and we're compelled to keep working because our other option is basically to starve. It's pretty clear that this select minority of like dictatorial bosses are not the ones doing the actual work, though. The closest Gina Reinhart has ever been to mining is putting on a high-vis for a photo opportunity. Jeff Bezos is not popping down to the Amazon production line or picking up some people's deliveries. And Michael Spence, the multimillionaire chancellor of this university, my uni, is certainly not up all night marking my assignments. So as socialists, we identify another class, the working class or the proletariat. They are, as the name would imply, the people who actually make the world go round. Ordinary people who have to survive by selling their labour time in order to make a wage. They teach in the hospitals, cook the food, drive the buses, attend to patients in hospitals, basically everything you can think of. Despite being the ones who do all the work, the working class, as I've said, have little to no say over how the work actually gets done. Marx identified the centre of this discrepancy as the fact that bosses own the means of production, effectively everything used to make work happen. The buildings, the tools, the resources, this is the key economic power of the capitalist class that means they can run industries according to their own narrow profit motive, no matter what workers think about it. But all of this doesn't mean that workers are without power. In fact, workers and ordinary people have an immense power, which I think will be the only saving grace of the planet. But before I address the socialist solution to these intrinsic problems, I want to go over some of the ways that we're kind of most often told that the planet can be saved. So the first is the idea of the individual solution. This is the concept that if enough single people take enough small actions, we can halt and then eventually turn around climate change. Think, you know, taking a shorter shower, going vegan, buying a reusable keep cup. I think the widespread popularity of these options reflects actually the fact that ordinary people feel really concerned about the environment and they want to do their part to help. But in reality, these actions are severely limited. They have a virtually non-existent impact on the environment due to the incomparably small impact of civilians next to that of corporations. We need to examine the real roots of the crisis if we're ever going to solve it, and these roots do not lie with individual actions. It's no accident, though, that so many businesses actually jump on these trends, attempt to spruik them by selling us these products or investing in sort of surface-level solutions. It's a really convenient way for companies to give themselves a green image, all the while placing the blame and therefore responsibility for climate change on the backs of ordinary people escaping condemnation themselves. But those who argue that something bigger than individual solutions need to happen can often propose something that's referred to as like green or eco-capitalism. So So they argue that the capitalist market can solve climate change. We just need to show the 1% that they should invest in renewables, let the innovative Elon Musks of the world design us electric cars and so on. This solution is a total fantasy. Capitalism is a system organised around garnering the biggest profits possible, and the reality is that non-renewables will always turn the biggest profit. What's more, capitalism is built upon competition. Bosses are constantly locked in a scramble to be the dominant force on the market. Everything is subsumed to this competition, including the future of the planet. There's currently around $12 trillion worth of oil still in the ground in reserves. If you ask a capitalist not to drill it up for the sake of the planet, he'll just respond by pointing out that if he doesn't, the next person will, and force him out of the market. But it's not just the fact that capitalism's nature makes a green economy impossible. Like, let's imagine for a second that it could happen. Capitalism would still be a fundamentally divided economic system based on a tiny minority hoarding wealth, while those who produce everything are divorced from that decision-making or wealth. It would still be a system that breeds homophobia, racism and sexism, as you'll hear about at some of the other sessions at the conference. Exploitation and oppression are inherent to this system, and no amount of investment in green solutions could make that acceptable. We need to get rid of this rotten system in its entirety. So the Marxist Walter Benjamin once proposed that Marx said that revolutions are the locomotive of history, but perhaps things are very different. It may be that revolutions are the act by which the human race travelling in the train applies the emergency brake. I keep actually coming back to this quote in my environmental activism. Benjamin was writing in the mid-20th century, and yet he could see really clearly where the steel tracks of capitalism were being laid, towards crisis, towards total environmental disaster. Our first task as activists is to pull those brakes. And our next task is to relay the tracks towards recovery and towards sustainability. The immediate issue at hand, one that most of us are currently dealing with, is taking action. All over the world, the environmental question is causing people to decide that rebellion is our only option in the face of an unrelenting system and inactive politicians. It started with Greta Thunberg and the school strikers, and now more and more people of all ages are taking up the fight. Across the country this month, we saw uni students protesting to build the global climate strike taking place in September. This March, we saw activists of 1.4 million around the globe mobilise in the March climate strike. And meanwhile, Extinction Rebellion activists, including many members of Socialist Alternative, are shutting down cities in acts of civil disobedience. As socialists, we don't just argue for mass protests and rallies because they're fun, even though they are. It's because they really work. It's easy to feel very atomised and powerless as an individual, like the most you can ever participate in politics is casting a vote every few years for whatever people seem like the least evil. It's much more empowering and much harder for politicians to ignore when you're in a gathering of 10, 20, 50,000 people in the streets demanding action. I think a great example of the power of social movements is the marriage equality campaign from a couple of years ago. For years, we'd faced down successive Liberal and Labor governments who refused to budge on the question. But by building a movement that started small and then grew into the hundreds of thousands, not only were politicians, like the Liberals of all people, actually forced to take action, but public opinion swayed to be increasingly pro-equal marriage. The campaign didn't just explode out of nowhere. It was built on the ground by activists, many of them socialists, who put in the work, leafleting, postering, organising. Capitalism does its best to make people feel powerless, and we are actually weaker when we're divided, but people in numbers are dangerous. Who can forget Scott Morrison's really bold and brave campaign to smear schoolchildren who dared to go out and protest? We do not support our schools being turned into parliaments. What we want is more learning and less activism. That right there is the contemptuous and I think quite fearful tone of a man who knows that protests can have a real impact on society. A great example of a mass environmental campaign was the Standing Rock or Dakota Access Pipeline protest in 2016. ETP, this mega gas corporation, was seeking to rip up Native American land in order to build a new pipeline. In response, thousands of people from across the states and the world joined in solidarity with the Sioux tribe, staking it out in inspiring displays of civil disobedience. The campaign is particularly relevant, I think, to us as it connected those questions of environmental activism and Indigenous land rights. The protest garnered widespread public sympathy for the cause, and they forced the initially gung-ho Obama government to retreat into first the potential of a reroute, and then further retreat into an environmental inquest before any construction could happen. Unfortunately, the election of Donald Trump and his insistence on signing a memorandum straight away, allowing construction to take place, really demobilised and disillusioned some people, and I think the movement waned when it really should have escalated. This ending teaches us something about the realities of capitalism and how we need to respond to it. The system is always one seeking to push back on any wins or gains we might make, and the response we need is to keep fighting and keep building. I think a lot of people feel pretty shattered after the election this year, but the response from activists needs to be relentless. The saying is, don't mourn, organise. Even under the most reactionary of governments, if we fight hard, we can win and protect our immediate demands. But this is a Marxist conference. We want to get rid of everything about this terrible system, not just win some demands here and there. Marx pointed out that capitalism, even in the very early stages that he was observing, brings with it a rift between humans and the environment like we've never seen before. And in order for this rift to be bridged, for humans to have a sustainable relationship with the planet, we need to do away with the logic of a system that gives ordinary people no control over society. You'd need a whole conference in itself, I think, to elaborate on the ways that society needs to be reshaped in order to turn the tides on climate change. The immediate shutdown of any commencing fossil fuel projects will be a start, followed by the mass implementation of renewable energy to facilitate a full transition. Massive reforestation projects would need to be taken up across the globe, including rehabilitation for animal species. Reparations that are long overdue for Indigenous communities would have to be distributed, as well as the rehoming of every single climate refugee currently stranded across the world today. Entire industries would be abolished or completely transformed in the name of sustainability, food production and transport being major areas. And I think cities would be rearranged and repurposed. Maybe my favourite, we would finally see the death of the fucking shopping mall, which is basically the urban world's like worst use of energy resources. The point is that all of these restructures and demands, whether major or minor, are about abandoning the profit motive in order to save the planet. There is no way that these can be undertaken when there is a ruling class presiding over every industry. Instead, they would have to be carried out in society where the people who actually do the work get to decide how it's done. The immense power and the potential of the working class, you know, the decisive possibility of this huge task of revolution, lies in the fact that without the working class, nothing actually gets done. And if nothing gets done, no one makes any profits. This is the economic power of workers, the power of a strike, the power of struggle, and this power, like the power of protest, can only be realised in numbers. We can get a glimpse into how the working class taking control over their labour can make huge gains for the environment from some union struggles of the past. One of the most inspiring and radical unions in Australian history was the Builders Labourers Federation, at the peak of their influence in the 70s. Whenever a development project was supposed to go ahead on land that was deemed to be environmentally important to Indigenous communities, they would take strike action and refuse to go ahead with the project. If it weren't for the BLF, the Botanic Gardens in Sydney would currently be a parking lot for the Opera House. You can Google that, it's true. The BLF's green bans were not a situation of revolution or of workers' power, but they were a glimpse into what happens when workers demand control over their lives and what this might be able to achieve for the environment. The BLF never made these environmental calls by themselves. They collaborated with activists and community groups. Like, imagine if a new development cropped up in your area and you and your neighbours actually got a say in it becoming something useful, like a school, a hospital, a library or a garden, rather than another high-rise apartment. Part of capitalism's role in history has been driving the world to a point of overproduction and extreme technological potential, all in the name of profit. These resources and all this knowledge is currently used merely for capitalists to make money, but they could be harnessed in really incredible ways. The ruling class have shown throughout history the lengths of depravity and violence that they're willing to go to keep a monopoly on all that power and knowledge. But I think ordinary people have shown, from Sudan to Hong Kong, from Russia to Egypt, their tenacity in fighting back, their refusal to take oppression lying down, and most importantly, their belief that they could run this system better than any of those fuckers. And for socialists, it's more than a belief, it's actually an imperative. The question of protest and building the environmental movement is tied inherently for socialists to this project of revolution. It's through movements and struggle, that people learn the real capacity they have, not just as individuals, but as a class, to change the world. It's why we throw ourselves into every campaign as some of the most dedicated activists on the ground. We want to take the fight to our schools, universities, and unions. We put the organising work in to make actions as big and as widespread as possible. We want to win our foremost demands, the things that our government could potentially enact immediately. But we also want to be pushing things forward towards revolutionary aspirations. We want to be making the argument to keep up the fight, even if it looks dire, to have those radical politics of anti-capitalism. If you want to be a part of this fight, it's imperative to get organised. As long as Socialist Alternative has existed, we've been committed to building movements and fighting for the climate, all while understanding the system at hand and pushing for an entirely new one. As the planet collapses around us, we need revolutionary politics to answer an immediately existential question. If you're not already, I'd urge everyone here to join and be part of that fight.
Sessions. Maddie, why don't you give us your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I thought that discussion was really, really excellent. A couple of things to address. On the question of people sort of committing to this new society, a socialist society, even one where they don't sort of make money from it, I keep thinking about Hong Kong. If people were present in the opening night last night, one of our speakers, Priya, talked about the activity of revolting workers and students. Like, not gross, like, revolting. who were, you know, buying food, supplying food, keeping the areas, like, the airports and the train stations, like, functional and clean, leaving around piles of money for people who didn't have any funds to collect. People obviously don't do this because they just gain immediately or monetarily from it. They do it because they feel ownership over the movement, over the city, and ultimately over their lives. It sort of evokes images of like the Arab Spring, when protesters in Tahrir Square were cleaning the area and every sort of media outlet was scratching their heads over why people would ever just want to voluntarily clean. It's because they no longer felt like it was this drudgery of just like, you know, having to perform these tasks for someone else, but actually it was about controlling their own lives. And as Gavin said in the discussion, this totally, yeah, transforms people's worldview. So the environmental question doesn't just raise this issue of, like, who owns Tahrir Square or who owns Hong Kong Airport. It actually poses the question of, like, who owns the entire planet. And it's why I really agree with what was said at the beginning of the discussion about revolutionary politics actually being the kind of only reasonable response to the climate crisis. Because socialism is about this mass empowerment of each person, about putting production in the hands of the producers. And when that happens, I think we can actually realise a sustainable society, not one where people are just sort of like nobly happy to go without and to tighten their belts. As the speaker highlighted, we have resources to provide for everyone. Capitalism's problem is actually about distribution. So not a society of austerity, but one of sort of revolutionary ownership and autonomy over how that society is run. So where maintaining it is not just this chore, but actually a fulfilling thing and a vital thing. And I think to achieve that, you need a revolution. So on that question that got raised at the end, which I think is really excellent, revolutions sort of happen because there are revolutionaries in them. This doesn't just mean that we can craft them out of thin air. You know, revolutions always explode from conditions that are not sort of meticulously drawn up by whatever Marxists are sitting around in society. But it means that when these movements erupt, there needs to be people who can engage with them, who can make those arguments. Some will be kind of the, you know, long-trained socialists who've been members of organisations for a long time. Some of them will be people who, in the days and weeks of, like, the sort of eruption of activity, will actually have come miles forward in their conception of what is possible and will be making those revolutionary arguments themselves. And I don't think this is sort of dampened by the 18-month deadline. You know, you want to talk about, like, 1917. Right up until kind of the point of revolution in Russia, there were a lot of revolutionaries who thought that it was not going to happen, that it wasn't possible. But then when those movements, those bread riots did start, they were able to adjust to that situation and go and agitate for an anti-capitalist sort of orientation. And I think that makes it... I really agree with the final speaker. I think that makes it imperative to be organised because there's kind of no telling what capitalism's going to bring in the next few years. I think it will maybe limp past some of those deadlines and get more authoritarian. So whatever happens, I think being organised as revolutionary socialists now is, you know, means that whatever happens, we're best prepared to intervene into that situation, do whatever we can to transform it into one that actually revolutionises society. A significant kind of presence of revolutionary organisation, it's what was sadly missing in Sudan. It's what's been kind of missing in all of these huge movements that haven't quite crystallised into something that totally overthrows capitalism. It's what was very present in Russia in 1917. I think we can't say that, you know, the presence of organised revolutionaries will just guarantee the success of a revolution, but I think we actually can say that their absence will almost definitely guarantee its failure, and that's what makes it so imperative to be organised, even now when it doesn't look like a revolution is happening next door, so that we're best prepared for that moment.